We have two roaming mics, left and right. So if you indicate you'd like a question, and perhaps when you have the microphone, briefly say who you are. Thank you. There's a question. We start there. We start here on the right. There's a question in the very back. Gentleman in the red tie.
Peter York. I wondered whether Frank thought it was a good or a bad thing for the girls to be what we now call sex workers, because you talked about those two girls, and you thought, well, one of them got a mortgage and one of them got wrecked. And so rather difficult to speculate on the basis of that, whether more of those girls who otherwise didn't have great saleable job market talents, and were, I mean, they definitely were sex workers, but rather more elevated sex workers, whether it was good or bad, liberating or devastating for girls to be in that new sex industry. How did it work out? Has somebody actually quantified and documented it?
I think that's a rather important question. Let's take that straight away, and then we group a couple up.
I mean, I think, Peter, it's probably important to distinguish and separate Christine Keeler and Mandy Rice Davis from the body of girls who are employed in this burgeoning industry. Rice Davis and Keeler are exceptional in many ways, but what they symbolize is a powerful, sexually assertive performance in the spaces of Soho, Notting Hill, Whitehall, and so forth. Whether I think it's a good thing, I tried in the lecture to sort of perhaps sidestep that terrain and say, rather than morally reinterrogating the 60s, really to try and ask some questions about where it comes from in a different way. So that was really my aim in the talk, rather than the kind of was this progressive, wasn't it? Undoubtedly, there was change, and it was pretty significant, and much of it was carried in this way. The other thing is that there is plenty of evidence about the sex workers themselves, and the largest body of it comes from the Metropolitan Police. Like I said in the lecture, you know, the Met are assiduous in compiling detailed dossiers from the 19th century about London's sexual proclivities and behaviours, and we get a very vivid picture of these girls. In Raymond's Review Bar, they are professionally trained, they're paid between £10 and £15 a week, they're on six-month contracts, so they're asked whether they like their job. So we get a picture of these girls.
I think the most important thing about Keeler and Davis is that Keeler was a working class girl who didn't know any better and had a beautiful body and was very ambitious. And Mandy Rice Davis was just as ambitious, but she was educated and much shrewder. And the most important thing about sexual workers is whether they stay sexual workers or they get out of it. Mandy got out of it and Christine never did anything else. I think the most important thing about sexual workers is the tiers of sexual workers that we talk about. It is one thing to dance in a performance which is perceived as erotic and conceived as erotic and perceived as erotic. And it is quite another thing to have to turn so many tricks a day for somebody else.
No, I think that was my sense of that question as well, which is still a vagueness about this whole register of the commercialised sex industry in Soho, the brothels that were still operating there, the sex shops, the peep shows, you know, the kind of 19th century style peep shows and burlesque. Because that's why Paul Raymond could market glamour as he did, because it was in terms of this kind of whole register of different kinds of commercialised sex. And I mean, you know, I think where did those women who were working at Raymond's live? Did they commute? You know, how did they move in and out of this space of Soho? So I think it could, you know, I think those are questions that do need elaboration, actually.
There were a couple more questions here in the front. Start with the gentleman with the beard and then move to Saskia. Over here. Thank you.
My name is Jim Kennedy. Professor Mort, I wonder whether anyone has ever done a systematic research of the evolution of the policy of the local authority, in this case the city of Westminster, in attempting to, shall we say, shape what was happening in Soho at this time. It seemed to me it would be a wonderful doctoral thesis or something.
Shall I answer? Yeah, sure. Westminster Council are, in a sense, the missing player in all of this, and in some senses for good reason, because Westminster Council really, through this period and beyond, are a very passive player in much of this, with the exception of some very grandiose and bizarre plans which are about really demolishing the whole of Soho and throwing across a sort of glass and steel streetscape at elevated level, which get no further than the architect's review. But so they are passive in, I think, the sense that they are not moving to close down in the kind of 19th century, early 20th century way. And it's really only until the 1980s, in the 1980s, that I guess in term with a view to rebranding again Soho's economy, that Westminster Council starts to step in to regulate the number of sex establishments. So in this period, I would say there is a deliberate passivity on the behalf of Westminster Authority, not on the behalf of part of the Metropolitan Police, who are very active in the prosecution of Raymond and a variety of other venues in Soho.
There's a question there.
Saskia Sissons. I wanted to pick up on something that Linda Need said about, you know, where was the female consumer? But Frank, you mentioned the advanced heterosexual couples who wanted sophisticated nighttime entertainment. Did they really exist? Did respectable middle-class husbands and wives go to these strip clubs together? Yes. And if so, what happened? Not continue? What's the legacy?
Yes.
I mean, it is argued that, you know, some women enjoy the modern equivalent pole dancing and so on, and there is a vogue for that. But right. What's the legacy of that?
Shall I come back on this issue about where are women in the narrative? I mean, obviously there is a tendency within this particular strand of the story for women to appear in rather traditional roles, perhaps. Let me say a little bit about where women are appearing in Soho in the 50s and early 60s. Well, there's the area of the sex worker, which we've touched on, but there are some more traditional roles. I mean, the long legacy of philanthropy and women's role in purity associations is still present in Soho in the 50s, quite strongly spearheaded by women. There is the women's import into the sort of bohemian culture around the Colony Room. I'm thinking of the hostess, the alternative hostess, Muriel Belcher, and artist Nina Hamnett, two of the key female players in that sort of bohemian circle. And yes, there are advanced heterosexual couples. I mean, that's one of the things that comes out of the Public Record Office research as the police interview these people from Dorking and... that's where we're talking. Some of these examples. Raymond is supposedly marketing his sexual style to women as well as men. That's his line. And there is a good deal of evidence about women being in the audience for these. Not overwhelmingly, but they are present. I'm interested in this issue also in relation to, I think, one of the comments that was made, and something I was trying to pull out and perhaps didn't do it very well. I think this is about an attempted reformation of English appetites. This was why I was right, and I think putting the food and story and the sex story together, it gives you some interesting insights into the way in which this is being done. Overwhelmingly, it's about a denial of the Puritan legacy. Right? I think that is one of the kind of overarching formulations of this rebranding. And I don't think it's clearly not just going on in Soho, but Soho is an important sort of site for some of this. So I'm interested in this in terms of kind of conventional notions of demand, which is one of the things I talked about in the lecture, but actually recasting that culturally and thinking about the way in which these different sectors of consumption intersect in Soho. That's a particular kind of interest of mine in terms of thinking about the history of affluence and the so-called permissive society.
It's interesting as well to think about its failure. I mean, that's what the point I was trying to make really about Elizabeth, people actually cooking Elizabeth David recipes, is that perhaps people were buying books. You know, I don't remember eating avocados until well into the late 70s. And it takes a long time for appetite to change. So, you know, I think that's the other kind of ripple effect one wants to be able to kind of to analyse, to understand, is how effective was this? And although at one point, I don't know if you were just sort of being, you know, obedient by saying this wasn't a London thing. It seems to me it is absolutely a metropolitan London thing, and more specifically your argument is that it's a Soho thing. It does become this kind of, you know, container for this attempt, but an attempt that takes quite a long time.
But if the women went to shop in Oxford Street and they went to buy other things other than clothes and furbelows in Regent Street, and they bought second-hand books and artworks and photographs in Charing Cross Road and all those areas. What's the fourth binding? What's the fourth side of this?
Coventry Street.
And they booked the theatres in Coventry Street and met their friends there for tea and coffee. We don't mind if they don't go to Soho. It's a controlled area. And that was why it was a unique experience. It was a particular thing. I think when this was first mentioned to me, I came to London when I was 17, and that was 1961. And I can remember, because I used to walk at night in London. You could in those days. It was safe in those days, or safer. And I can remember a woman appearing out of the street, a very handsome blonde woman bearing down at me and saying, "Get off my beat." And I didn't know what a beat was. I thought policemen had a beat. And I said, I'm terribly sorry, being a nice, well-brought-up child, and scuttled off and said to somebody, "What? Do you know what she meant?" Fool, of course. And it was as matter-of-fact as that. I don't think that was a bad thing, necessarily. And, you know, the Metropolitan Police and their great attention to they've got to, I mean, it's part of their job, is to document everything obsessively. One of the reasons that they relaxed so much about cottaging was because they pulled so many parsons out of cottages, it was embarrassing. So there's a kind of raucousness about all this. It was much, much earthier, much more accessible than this, what it's become now, which is kind of, it's flowed into all those places, into all those main four thoroughfares. And so the only thing that Soho could do was be more over the top, be more about the sex workers, be more about sex as a commodity. And if Westminster Council has turned its nose up and said, "Well, we're not terribly interested in all that," it was because it was a controlled experiment. Thank you, leave it alone. It's bounded by those four streets, and as long as it doesn't overflow so much that it frightens the horses or upset any of the good burghers who are paying taxes elsewhere, that's fine. Leave it there.
There are a couple of more questions, just to indicate them here and then in the front.
Tony Dunn. And take up the point you made, Frank, about Raymond's Review Bar and what you called his attempt to create a mature pleasure economy. And I wonder if you'd see that as absolutely analogous to what Hefner was doing with Playboy in the 1960s, whereby by the end of the 1960s, he was claiming to have a stake in the sexual revolution. And there were very well-known and respected writers that were writing for Playboy. Norman Mailer was certainly among them. And if you put that together with, obviously, the heavy advertising base of it, I wonder if you'd see Hefner as someone who was trying to fight American Puritanism by way of this kind of sophistication.
Let's take a couple more. There was someone... There. Lady with the glasses there, and then we come to you.
Well, it's not quite the same question at all. I just thought it was a wonderfully sophisticated analysis of the sedimented levels. I very much like that, Frank. I wanted to ask, and in a way rather take issue with Anna here, about another group which are mentioned but not fully, which are the theatrical camp area of Soho, because my strongest memory of this is being taken by the gay novelist Angus Wilson with his partner to the first night of a Jordan play, which was at the boundaries of Soho. It was in the Criterion Theatre, where you had to be a member to go. And as a young 18-year-old Newcastle girl, it was astonishing, camp, wonderful evening of a world, obviously, that I'd never even imagined could exist. I imagine that that was based on several other other earlier performances. And I wondered, where was this gay camp world, and how much part of Soho was it?
Right. Let's take these two, and then I've seen the two here. But let's take these two. Yeah. They actually do speak to each other, I think.
But yes.
Frank, why don't you
What Raymond stands for, and this notion of the mature pleasure economy and how one can relate it to other entrepreneurs in the 60s. What I was trying to argue here, what I was trying to do here is to really open up a debate about, I suppose, the sexual content or a certain strand of the sexual content of the 1960s, and to say that rather than deal in generalities, and this is my kind of point overall about dealing with consumption and commodities, let's take specific sites, let's take specific types of performance in this case, and let's look at the iconography of sex as it's represented in somewhere like the Raymond's Review Bar. Now, I think you can, as I said at the towards the end, I think a logical extension of that is into the kind of whole debate about swinging London of the 60s. And clearly, Raymond plays an important part in that as an entrepreneur, as a very flamboyant mover through the spaces of London. And I think you can see him as a kind of type for many others. That's my kind of modernizing point. But the other point I was trying to stress really is the fact that in order for this to happen, it needs to build on an earlier history of transgressive sex. And the relationship between the modern and the traditional in this site is actually rather complex, as it is in many areas of London and in British society throughout the 50s and 60s. So there I'm taking issue with that kind of developmental notion of everything changes, yeah, that Britain is on the move, all the stuff we know at the time that's celebrated by Wilson and technological white heat and such things. What I'm arguing is really about a version of change, but change which often is often clothed, if you'll excuse the pun, in very conservative forms. Yeah, and I think if you take Profumo is a real example of that. Here is a story which is partly modern and partly highly traditional in the way it deals with sexual scandal. Part of it could come out of 1885 and, you know, the Maiden Tribute. Part of it couldn't. So I'm really trying to, to try and highlight some of the complexities around cultural and sexual change in the period. Theatrical camp, very briefly. The other part of this story is about homosexual culture in the area. And Maggie, there are many different forms, and I was just very quickly trying to indicate some of them. There are part of the Raymond's performance in the early days is about male nude review. He has a Sunday night, which is about male strip. And many of the men in the audience are, in inverted commas, very effeminate. This is Metropolitan Police. But there is, you know, there is rough trade. There are the discreet, more discreet middle-class private members' clubs in Soho, frequented people like Peter Wildblood, who's written Against the Law in 55. There's the Fitzroy Tavern north of Oxford Street, which is also about, you know, quite elaborate forms of sexual connection, often involved, you know, the forces, so on. There are many, many forms. Theatrical camp, I actually know less about in terms of the theatre industry, I suppose.
Do you want to briefly come in on that? There were two questions here, and then I see the gentleman in the background view over there. So one is right next to you, yes.
Eugene Quinn from World Service. I found this Pathé newsreel astonishing. It was a real revelation that this chap seemed to have had a few glasses of wine before he wrote this poem about winkles and things. It was delightful and not at all judgmental, which was interesting. He seemed to be very, very keen on the Soho Festival. I wanted to know what happened to the Soho Festival. When did it finish and why?
Yes.
Let's take Mika Nava, the lady back there. Thank you.
Hello, Mika Nava. I wanted to add something to the debate about the sex, Soho being this kind of sexual centre, because it wasn't just for sex workers or for gay people. There was also, it was the heart of a kind of sexual libertarianism that was already developing in the 1950s. And I think there were a number, Charing Cross Road, of course, there was St. Martin's Art School, that Slade was not very far away. There were large numbers of students who were hanging around there. And some of the figures, the well-known figures were, I mean, Lucian Freud, John Minton, who did the first cover of the first Elizabeth David cookbook, also one of those figures who frequented Muriel's. And so on. So I think there's a kind of avant-gardism about Soho at the time that mustn't be forgotten in this account, which is rather seedy and which sort of suggests that everybody was kind of in there for the kind of commercial relationship to sex. That wasn't the case. There were also coffee bars, poetry readings, a kind of whole new generation of sort of beatniks and bohemians and jazz lovers and so on. I mean, you did mention the jazz. The jazz was sort of around the edges, you know, there was the 100 Club in Oxford Street and so on. But nevertheless, the people who went there were part of that. And I know you know that, but it didn't come across in this lecture very much, but just wanted to add that. Yeah.
I wanted to pick up on what happens to the Soho Fair, the festival, partly in terms of what Lynn said about, you know, what are the effects of this. Well, one of the what seems, I mean, maybe I'm rather naive, and I'm certainly naive as a sort of historian of film, but I was very interested to see that Pathé News covers this event throughout its life, from 55 through to 61. It's always there in the summer issues of Pathé Newsreel, which is shown nationwide. It's given about 3 minutes, which is actually quite a lot in terms of an event of this sort. So in terms of dissemination, I mean, I think there are different levels of dissemination, and one is clearly about dissemination through the national media. I would be interested to see, and I don't know, whether Soho is covered in early TV, for example, which is making headroads in certain types of, you know, news coverage in the mid-1950s. Certainly around sex it is. I mean, television covers the Wolfenden Report when it's released in 57. When it finishes in 61, and it's slightly unclear why. Because every year it's been publicised as a success, and it's built and it's grown, and Soho and so on. I rather think that underneath that is the issue that it's sex that takes off rather than the type of cosmopolitan continental atmosphere that the organisers hope. But in answer to your question, I actually don't know enough about Soho's demise. It's not the only time. I mean, there have been early attempts at this in the 30s and in the 1890s. Very different form in those earlier periods. But I think we're moving by the early 60s into a different phase of Soho's development, if you like, and not one where this kind of continentalism predominates. You're absolutely right, Mika. I mean, there are, you know, other parts of the story, and the Bohemian element is very present. The Bohemians keep something of a distance from Soho Fair. I think they see it as too commercial. There is a picture of Daniel Farson talking to one of the organisers, but I don't have a... It's interesting that they don't get involved. And I think that kind of avant-garde culture and its relation to commercial re-promotion of the area is probably quite complex and often quite fraught. You know, there are different strands, different types of consumers at work here. But it is absolutely, isn't it? And the student population too. I entirely agree.
I just wanted to add, it's a really kind of simple point of information. I think that the mad rhyming thing about all the foods going, I think that's an old Punch poem, because so which absolutely fits with your argument that this is a kind of older, early 20th century sort of Edwardian scripting of Soho that then gets laid over this extraordinary film. I think it's happening there too.
Final questions were gentleman in the back, and then lady on the right. Thank you.
Thank you. It was two comments on the policing of the sex industry, if I may. First of all, I'm not convinced about the activity of police enforcement by clubs and vice unit. It was an easy area for prosecutions and convictions. It was also a very easy area for bribery and selective policing and closures. And the second point, which is more problematic, I'm not quite sure about this hierarchy of the sex industry. You could argue that prostitution in Ronnie Scott's in that period is more or less paralleled today by lap dancing clubs closed down with allegations of soliciting for prostitution in our own period.
Jane Chazelska. A bit further north, there was a famous lesbian club called Gateways. I think that was in King's Cross. You didn't mention much about lesbian culture in Soho, and I just wondered what you knew about that.
The police. I mean, really another kind of key player in all of this, and extremely complicated relationship to the policing of sexual London from the 19th century. I mean, this is not a straightforward form of, you know, social and sexual regulation. You mentioned corruption, bribery, all of those things. This is the notorious C division Soho is in, if we're talking about divisions. But there is also, you know, clearly police participation in these sexual forms. And there is a very strange, not so strange perhaps, but quite an exotic relationship on the part of the civil servants who, you know, when you look at the Wolfenden Committee, they are transfixed with this area. You know, again, it relates to this question that we raised about the significance of Soho. Well, for sex, Soho takes on a kind of national significance, where policymakers and bureaucrats actually make new laws or recommendations for on the basis of a square mile of streets around Piccadilly Circus. It's extraordinary, the actual minuscule or micro area, you know, that this is involved. They go elsewhere, but they return again and again to this area. Hierarchy of the sex industry, I'm confused about this. There is certainly a hierarchy among female sex workers in the period, yes, and I've, you know, plenty. I mean, and that's spatial too. You know, Mayfair retains its deluxe credentials throughout the 50s. It's the Mayfair girls that the Wolfenden Committee want to interview, not the girls in Soho or in Whitechapel. So, lesbian culture, I think, not in Soho. In the period, I thought the Gateways was actually in West London, is it not, rather than King's Cross? But correct me if I'm wrong. But the spaces that are defined in this period are really male homosexual spaces, I would say. I don't have any evidence of Soho being defined as a lesbian space in the 50s and early 60s. It's a rather negative.
No, no. Then I have the opportunity to invite you to join us at a small reception in the rooms just behind you. But before we do that, let me remind you that this lecture series and discussion will continue in the new year with a very different set of topics, ranging from the power of credit cards to consuming kids and fashion consumers. The next public lecture will be on Friday, the 23rd of January, on the rise of the credit card nation, and will be given by Robert Manning, who is a leading academic and consumer advocate in the United States, and amongst many other things, advisor to Senator Edwards, the Democratic candidate. And more information is in the yellow leaflet, which you can pick up if you haven't done so on your way out. But I want particularly to thank again Frank Mort for a wonderful lecture, to Lynn and Anna for very perceptive and interesting comments, and to you for questions and discussion. Thank you, Frank.